Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 260, we're pleased to bring you a preview of the October 2020 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com and is also released in print to retinal specialists in the United States and other countries. I'm joined by Drs. Daniel Chow and Nicholas Farber to discuss four articles. We discuss using analytics for a retina practice, the applications of artificial intelligence to interpreting retinal imaging. We also discuss using hybrid virtual and in-person clinics and how to combine those visit types, and end with the discussion of the management of endophthalmitis complicated by retinal detachment. As always, financial disclosures for all participants can be found in the episode description. Please also note that you can claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website by clicking on the link in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retina specialists for this preview of the October edition of Retinal Physician. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Daniel Chow from San Diego, California. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay.
And next in his first appearance on the program, Dr. Nicholas Farber from Tallahassee, Florida. Nick, welcome.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
So, as always, we're not going to go through these articles in exhaustive detail. I'm just going to summarize them. We'll use them as jumping off points for discussion. And the articles can be found online for free at retinalphysician.com. The first article we're going to talk about is this article about integrated analytics and retina practices by Ellie Talman. And Ellie is the administrator at Retina and Vitreous at Texas and kind of talks about how they're implementing analytics to analyze how retina practices functions, analyze how they can streamline things, how they can kind of maximize the efficiency of the practice. And he goes through various metrics, for example, patient volume per physician, how many new patients each physician is seeing, how often they're overbooked, how are their payments comparing to the past or to the contracts they're signing with different insurance companies. And then very interesting is talking about how retina injections work in terms of float and then getting the payment back for these expensive medications. And then finally kind of deciding how do you do this. So there's different companies that actually offer health analytics. And I think some of us may have practices that do that. I think at the university, Dan, you and I, the university has some degree of this. Nick, I'd be curious if your practice uses this. We'll talk about that in a second. But let's start with this. You know, I think that analytics in medicine is very much like analytics in professional sports, where I think there's tremendous value and it can really change a lot of our paradigms. You may have preconceived notions that something is good, and then you find after looking at the analytics that something is actually not as good. But medicine, much like sports, is more than the numbers. And I think sometimes there is a danger of boiling down too much to numbers. I'm going to start with you, Dan. Do you receive analytics reports from the university? And that could range from anything from just something as simple as your productivity relative to prior years or prior months, or some more complex analyses of, for example, your new patients, your payments, injections, et cetera.
So I do not, Jay. And I think this is a point that academic centers, there's a huge range of improvement. And I'll go into that a little bit later. In terms of the analytics that are available to me, so at the university, we use Epic. There are some dashboards, like a financial dashboard, which will show how much you've collected, how much you've billed, the number of new patients, but it's quite limited, and we certainly don't have any education in it. In terms of my department, there was someone who would try to play around a little bit with scheduling and had looked a little bit into the analytics and figured out some better ways of potentially scheduling things, but it never really took off. And again, I agree with you. I think this is a huge area of data that can certainly streamline and optimize clinical time and clinical revenue. And I think in the academic setting, there's a number of reasons perhaps why this doesn't occur. One is just the centralized nature of a lot of these things. As you know, Even ophthalmology departments perhaps may not have that much control, for instance, for billing, for hiring their employees. And there's no one really, so there's not much incentive sometimes within the department to optimize these particular things or look at these analytics, and especially for distribution of clinical resources. I don't think anyone is really paying really strong attention to that. So individuals who may be seeing a lot of patients and generating RVUs may still not have adequate resources to really see these patients efficiently compared to perhaps more senior clinicians who, based on the analytics, there may be a disproportionate allocation of the resources. So I agree. I think this is a great thing, and I wish it was certainly more employed in the academic university setting.
Nick, what about your practice? Are you in a retina-only or multi-specialty group? And then if your practice does utilize kind of reports, how often do you receive them and what information does it contain?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting topic. So I'm in a retina-only practice, and we're in North Florida, primarily Tallahassee, and also in South Georgia. And so we do use, I think the article makes a good point in talking about integration of your EHR with your practice management. So I do not specifically get printouts, but I do speak to our practice manager often about how many new patients I'm seeing, my flow through clinic, my efficiency, and it definitely helps. So as somebody who's been in practice just a little over 2 years, I'm very concerned about and thinking about how is my practice growing? How many new patients am I seeing? How is that distribution? And to Dan's point about staff allocation, we definitely have a model for that, utilizing this system and how many patients people, doctors are seeing and how much staff is utilized and sent for those clinics in order to staff them appropriately. I've also been involved in starting two new clinics as part of our practice. And so the new patients and the revenue streams and how the payers, and especially across different state lines, are paying is different. And being able to track those, being able to make sure that we are managing our high-cost drugs effectively is a big deal. And it's important. So though I don't get a exact printout, it's something that I'm constantly talking to our practice manager about in order to increase my efficiency and find the bottlenecks. Even if it's just as simple as I'm taking longer to do a laser than one of the senior partners, maybe those patients are moved towards the end of the clinic day, so they're not slowing down some rechecks, some intravitreal injections. And so using it on a micro level, but also as a macro, I think when it comes to managing staff, everybody likes to have set expectations that are known and established. And if you can catalog that, which is what they talk about in the office, to have actual metrics to measure people for, I think staff responds to that. If they know what their expectations are, how to hit them, or if they don't, ways to improve, I think it takes some of the guesswork and the feeling work out of it and makes it more analytical.
Yeah, and these are all real good potential benefits of analytics. I'm always the cynic who's kind of worried about potential downsides, and I think the benefits outweigh the risks. I think having more information is never a bad thing. But Dan, do you think there are any disadvantages to quantifying sort of what we do? I mean, I wonder if in settings like an academic setting or a private equity setting or settings where physicians are not in ownership and administrators are looking at numbers, there are certain things that just aren't captured either in analytics of utilization of resources, analytics of, for example, payments. Complexity of cases is captured really poorly by ICD-10 and CPT codes. Quality of care delivered, bedside manner, these things aren't necessarily quantified. And maybe, again, they're not important to the business structure because they don't actually matter at this point in terms of reimbursement, but they do matter to our patients. So how do we kind of fight, to use analytics without it turning into a double-edged sword?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And again, I think this is one piece of data that you put into the whole puzzle. And I think it's really incumbent on a practice manager, someone that's really focused on these issues. And certainly I have a question for Nick at some point, just to understand how many people are really dedicated to analyzing these different analytics. Is it primarily the practice manager, or are there multiple people that help with that, just in the terms of, how much people resources do you really need to implement that? But just to go back to your point, you know, I think certainly in an academic center, I think RVUs are one way to try to normalize between patient payer mix that physicians may see. But, you know, I think certainly in the academic setting, it's a little bit different. There's also aspects of teaching that might make the clinic longer, or also the surgeries longer. And so I think being completely bottom line and financially driven, you know, doesn't make complete sense in an academic environment. But I think certainly we could use a lot more of that to streamline the operations.
Nick, any final thoughts on this before we move on to the next article?
Dan, to address your question first. So how many people are dedicated towards this? That's an excellent question. I only speak to our practice manager about it, but I don't know if there are more human resources people. So what is the cost benefit in terms of time spent analyzing this versus benefit? I'm not really sure. Maybe they're analyzing it. But I also, to your point, one of the drawbacks I was thinking is, how do you quantify teaching? And, you know, okay, I've got a fellow, or I've got a resident, now I've got medical students. And the practice where this paper comes from, they do have a fellowship. So I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about that from them. In our practice, we do not have an associated fellowship. We do have some teaching, and I'm involved in it, but you can't quantify that. You can't say, a resident's going to take 5 more minutes or 10 more minutes, and RVUs are, you know, attributed thusly. So I do agree, you can't moneyball everything. There also has to be some big picture feel for it.
Well, the next article we're going to talk about is Parallel In-Office and Virtual Clinics for Retina Practice Post-COVID-19, with the subtitle, A Hybrid Model Can Provide Safe, Efficient, Efficacious Care. Ihsan Rahimi, Steve Houston, John Miller put this together. And just to summarize again, they talk about the COVID-19 pandemic and kind of the things that initiated in terms of telemedicine, but the idea of maybe having these virtual clinics, or having sort of a hybrid telemedicine or tele-eye care protocol, where you can have patients come in, get imaging, and then have a discussion over the phone, either via live video or a traditional phone call to review their results, things to streamline injections, for example, kind of staggering the appointments appropriately, and kind of, you could maybe have both. You could have a virtual clinic running simultaneously with an in-person clinic. This kind of ties into analytics thing and efficiency. If you could probably stagger this in a way where it works really, really well for a practice. Nick, we're going to snake back. I'm going to ask you, you know, I'm curious. I find that we had, for example, at Bascom Palmer, significant demand. We're running these Saturday hybrid telemedicine clinics where patients come and get their imaging, like their 6-month OCT for dry AMD, and then clinician would call them and review the results. And that demand dwindled out as time went forward. Patients still wanted to come in and kind of do their in-person visit during the week. Have you found a similar thing? Did your practice try to initiate any sort of hybrid clinics during the pandemic? And have you noted any trends? Have you tried to continue these telemedicine visits beyond when the numbers were higher and things were shut down?
So I thought this was a thought-provoking article. And actually, when I had first heard of Dr. Houston down in Orlando doing some of these, I had spoken to our partners about attributing them. And I think ideally these work in a setting where you have multiple offices, so you have space that is going unused, and you have excess staff that can do this. So you need a staff member in one of your satellite clinics in order to run these. And then the physician, while, you know, in a parallel clinic, let's say during your morning injection clinic, you're also every 15 minutes having a virtual visit with someone in an office 100 miles away, you know, with a staff member not being used. We did not incorporate this, and we did not use a lot of telemedicine, mostly because when we are not in an office, that staff travels. So it's not just our physicians who travels, but our staff also, in order to meet akin to the last paper, but the staffing needs for the individual offices. So we actually didn't have the excess staff in order to go in and kind of make this work. I do think what you're saying in terms of, as the pandemic has gone on, people are slightly less inclined to do these. I wonder if the patients are seeing the benefit, the same benefit of a virtual visit versus an in-person visit, because we know that coding-wise and reimbursement-wise, you know, if somebody had to pay out of pocket, are they going to want to pay the same amount as if they had an in-person visit? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that, but I would wonder if their time value, are they seeing it diminished? Because at the end of the day, they do want to see a doctor, and that is the historical model. That doesn't mean it can't change, but it's, of course, you know, change is hard. And as time goes on, people want to revert back to what's comfortable.
Yeah, great points. And I remember when we were talking maybe back in May or June on an episode, we talked about how patients were very grateful for these visits. But I brought up the semi-cynical idea was, well, as things sort of return to a new normal and people kind of come out of this, you know, the acute part of this stressor, are they still going to have the same sort of gratitude? Or are they going to look at this and be like, well, I'm not necessarily getting the same value out of this yet. I'm still paying the same amount or paying a copay or if I'm paying out of pocket, I'm not necessarily getting the value I would expect for paying this, right? Even though, like you said, the reimbursement may be the same. Dan, what's been your experience at San Diego, and what are your thoughts longer term about this sort of hybrid approach for clinics?
Yeah, I think those are all fantastic points that Nick had made. To add, we have not utilized telemedicine at all, and I think it's partly for some of the reasons that Nick had mentioned in terms of requiring additional staffing as well as additional photography equipment during the weekday. We haven't tried to do it on the weekends, which would be another way of doing it. You know, one other thought I had is just in general about this model is that, like, does it work? The question is, with just the wide field imaging and the OCT, are we really missing something that we would see, let's say, on an exam or plus minus the visual acuity, and what's the number needed to harm in this case? And I think actually it's quite low. And I think in the article they discuss, well, obviously you'll triage different patients. If they have symptoms of a retinal detachment or something more acute, then those patients would be seen versus regular follow-up or screening would work very well in this hybrid model. And so my thought is that, you know, in the future, if we work out some of these staffing equipment issues, that certainly this could be a very attractive model. And I think going back to analytics could be very cost effective as well. And, you know, I think one of the really interesting studies to do beforehand is, okay, well, let's see, how much are we missing? If we were to come up with our diagnosis and plan just after reviewing the imaging and the visual acuity, how much does that change after we do the exam? And I feel, at least in my clinic, it more or less, that's what I'm doing. I'm pre-reviewing the imaging, visual acuity, and by that time, I have a pretty good idea of the plan, and it's quite rare that things will change.
Yeah, and I think it depends, like you said, a lot on the pathology that you're dealing with, right? If you're talking about a patient who is getting injections at a steady course or a dry AMD patient who's there for their six-month follow-up, you know, there's there's probably not as much that the exam is adding, barring some significant asymptomatic change, which we do find asymptomatic changes. You know, for example, you could maybe capture some of that in a wide field fundus photography, for example. I think if you're talking about a patient who is a postoperative patient or after surgery, now you're not getting paid for those patients anyway, but the pathology and our ability to image it is a little bit different depending on how peripheral the pathology is. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of things here to unpack. You know, I'm going to kind of pivot to our next article just because it's a good, smooth transition. It's called An Artificial Intelligence as a Disruptor to AMD Diagnosis. And the subtitle is Companies Plan for an Expanded Role for AI in Retina Therapies. And this was an article just talking about different artificial intelligence systems that are being developed to plan treatments potentially for patients with wet macular degeneration, especially as our treatment maybe gets more complex in the future in terms of treating not just wet but dry and having multiple agents. There's this belief that artificial intelligence can help in terms of not only screening for AMD, but in terms of predicting which patients will progress and predicting when patients will need further treatment. Nick, again, this is kind of tying into the whole idea of maybe what the way we practice is not the way we're going to be practicing in a few years. Do you think this is on the horizon? Do you think there's going to be a point that retina specialists are a little more like radiation oncologists, for example, where we have these set algorithms for how we treat certain things, and we're really just making some decisions based on those algorithms and studies? Do you think that our exams are going to be kind of superseded by imaging, as we were referring to with the discussion of the hybrid clinic, and we're going to be more like radiologists in some sense, where we're interpreting imaging. What are your thoughts on what this means for the future of retina care?
I think those are great questions. And I think at the heart, retina is still a surgical subspecialty. And so there are things that we do that intervene. We do a scleral depressed exam. We're doing an intravitreal injection. And, you know, a pre-op surgical visit, I think, cannot be standardized in that way like a radiologist. I don't mean, you know, I think the concern, you know, if you read a science fiction novel talking about AI, it's that AI is going to take over and take the place of the person doing it. And I did not get that sense from this article. And I don't think that's where it's going. I think that their point is to enhance what we are already doing. You know, before OCT, did all retina specialists think that their exam wasn't good enough to diagnose DME and AMD? Of course not. They thought they were doing a great job, and they were. But now we know we have this new modality, and I think it would be, it's not unheard of, but, you know, we would all prefer to have an OCT when we're looking at a wet AMD patient and a diabetic macular edema patient in order to enhance our diagnoses and then stratify our treatment paradigms. I do think it's interesting. They make the point that they're going to, with AI, find patients that we don't already have, that there's an unmet need, that one of the points they make is we may be inundated with millions of new patients. And I find that a little difficult to believe in the sense that, you know, I've been a part of a clinic called the Remote Area Medical Clinic in Wise, Virginia. So Wise is between North Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky, and North Carolina, right where they meet. Those people are still not going to have access to artificial intelligence. How are you going to get them in front of this camera? You know, are we really getting the access to the places we need it? Are we really meeting that unmet need where we will be inundated and just, you know, be doing injection after injection after injection because we're not even seeing dry AMD anymore, just the artificial intelligence is seeing that? I have a hard time thinking that's true. I do think you could use this with telemedicine, and patients who are very comfortable with at-home diagnoses and monitoring systems are going to be the same ones who are probably comfortable with a telemedicine visit and using AI to follow their progression. You know, those are the Plaquenil screenings, the pentosan polysulfate screenings, the new interstitial cystitis issues with maculopathy. Anytime you're looking for progression going from moderate to severe in PDR, I think those are good cases that artificial intelligence and telemedicine can really help address. But I think at some point we, you know, as clinicians need to exert our clinical judgment.
Yeah, great points. And I think the argument, Nick, I guess, would be that similar to the screening things that Walmart, for example, or other large sort of widespread pharmacy type organizations are interested in, that this would be something that would be put in a Walmart or a Target similar to a blood pressure cup for screening. Now, the finances have to work out for that. It'd be interesting to see that there's a whole different discussion of the business strategy for that. Dan, any right. thoughts on what Nick was saying or this idea, again, of the paradigm shift for how at least medical retina will change?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is this technology, I think, is going to be coming, at least the technology is going to be ready for clinical use, I would definitely say, in the next 5 years, if not sooner. And I think certainly some paradigms are going to change. I think there's this idea of home monitoring, particularly for AMD, that's been around for a long time and hasn't been quite, it's clearly been shown through a lot of work through no-tell vision that that early detection is helpful and can save vision, and there's just been some issues in terms of how to implement that. But, you know, I think as we had actually discussed in a previous journal club about paper on AI algorithms and looking at the ARIF to 10-year follow-up, is that, you know, it was just as effective or even more in terms of evaluating the presence of fluid compared to retina specialists in a clinical trial setting. So I think certainly the technology is going to be there to help diagnose and certainly screen for AMD, certainly in an OCT type of setting. And I think the big question is how do we implement it? You know, what are the financial incentives that will make sense for this system to happen? But I think this model of AMD patients, you know, getting monitored in some type of aspect and then coming in for various treatments and maybe there's some special clinic, I think is certainly very attractive in a lot of ways. And we'll have to see how it plays out, because ultimately, I think providing better care for patients and allowing physicians to treat a greater number is certainly one of the goals. I think in terms of AI, a couple of big points. One is, and I think this was brought up in the article, and also Michael Abramoff has been talking quite a lot about this, the founder of IDX, is are they responsible for liability in cases of undiagnosed cases of either like the thing that they're looking to diagnose, or perhaps things that are caught on the fundus photography that is not related to, say, diabetic retinopathy? An example of, let's say there is a choroidal melanoma in a patient, and the algorithm is just, it's really good at recognizing diabetic retinopathy, but really not recognizing anything else. And our company, especially in autonomous AI, our company is liable. And I think Michael Abramoff has come out with a very strong stance that that they indeed should take responsibility for it and develop strategies to anticipate that and to take that into when they're building the AI. The other thing is just in terms of prognosis. The article mentions a study by Pierce Keene in which they were looking at eyes that have had wet AMD, and if they could find anything in the OCT that would predict CNV and the other eyes to develop. So these are things, trying to predict things in the future that we cannot currently, that we may be able to take out of the current OCTs. And so it'll be really interesting as that technology develops, as that data comes in, how that ends up changing our practice. But I agree with Nick. I think these are all mostly assistive technologies that are going to be used to enhance the delivery of care for retina specialists. But certainly we're still far away from these machines replacing retina specialists, even in medical retina.
Yeah, really good points and really good discussion. The last article is not really tied into this, so I'm just going to do an abrupt segue here. And the last article has the title Management of Concurrent and Delayed Onset Retinal Detachment Associated with Endophthalmitis, a peer-reviewed article with two Bascom Palmer residents, Thomas Lazzarini and Hassanin Alkhirsan, J.J. Echegaray from Case Western, and Dr. Harry Flynn here from Bascom as the authors. And again, this is to summarize, they just go through how to manage these patients, that retinal detachment does happen in these patients who get endophthalmitis. The incidence varies depending on the etiology of endophthalmitis. And then the things to think about in terms of what do you do if there's a retinal detachment when they present with endophthalmitis, and what do you do if they develop a retinal detachment later? What do you do with intravitreal antimicrobials? What's your dosing? Do you buckle or not? Is it worth thinking about tamponade oil versus gas? Is there any value, for example, for systemic antibiotics? Again, this is a worst case scenario. I think the one big take home point is once you have endophthalmitis with the retinal detachment, especially if they present with that, the visual prognosis can unfortunately be very, very poor. Again, just a quick questions for both of you. Nick, unfortunately, this is something that you get referred as a retina specialist, whether it's post-cataract, post-injection, or any other etiology. Obviously, we have EVS criteria that guide us, for example, for post-cataract endophthalmitis. And again, we have things such as OR availability that sometimes dictate in other scenarios whether or not we take a patient to surgery, as well as the patient's concurrent medical status. But what is kind of your threshold, for example, to take a patient to surgery? And what are your thoughts, for example, on the use of silicone oil for these patients? Do you ever use silicone oil when you're doing vitrectomy for endophthalmitis? And what are kind of your goals? If you do a vitrectomy for endophthalmitis, how much of a vitrectomy are you doing?
Great questions. So to go back to start on your first one, in regards to the EVS, what I was always taught was a main drawback, or not drawback, but a limitation of that study, is they excluded everybody who did not have a clear view. So a clear view to the iris, clear view to at least the anterior vitreous. And so you're really self-selecting out the most virulent organisms. And in these scenarios, whether it's post-traumatic, post-injection, endogenous, or post-operative blep-related late, especially post-traumatic, you're seeing much more virulent organisms. In an endogenous, and one thing I found really interesting about this article was the rate of retinal detachment in the setting of fungemia versus bacteremia, with a much higher rate when it was a fungal bug. And so you know, already it's difficult to apply those criteria. So for me, I operate mostly in an ASC, but I do have privileges and operate at our main hospital as well. And so my first step, and what they also mention in the article, is control the infection. You know, similar to an open globe with a retinal detachment, first close the globe and then, you know, go on to the next step. So I'm always doing a tap and inject in the office, even if I'm going to take that patient to surgery, because I want to start that process right away with the antibiotics in there. And then as far as when to take them, you know, yes, if they have LP or worse vision, I'm inclined to. And I think a lot of it depends on those surgical factors, such as how is the view. I do not have access to endoscopic vitrectomy. One of the points they make kind of throughout here is one of the main reasons for having a late onset retinal detachment are the where you do the injection site. Is there contraction of the membrane? So are we actually, or if you do an early vitrectomy, is it at those, is it where you're putting your trocars? So are we sometimes causing more harm than good? You know, first do no harm is always our main principle. So I think if there's an adequate view, and if it's LP vision or worse, then I want to take that patient to surgery. But, you know, without that, it depends on the setting, of course. It depends on, was there trauma? Is there an IOFB? You know, are we controlling fungemia? But, you know, in those settings, I would try to take the patient to surgery.
Dan, Nick brought up some great points there. And I think the biggest take-home point is how much the view kind of dictates really the answers to all the questions I asked him. You know, I think that one of the points I try to tell fellows, like Nick was saying, you can do more harm good, first avoid harm. And I think that unfortunately comes down to your view. Now, there are things you can do surgically to improve the view, such as removing debris from the anterior chamber, washing it out. It can be easier and a little safer in a patient who's pseudophakic than phakic when you don't have a clear view. Any other thoughts on approaching these cases? Anything else from this article that struck you or you want to point out or talk about?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think Nick brought up a great point about the view. And I think for me, at least, a lot of times those patients with perhaps not the best view are actually the ones that I end up taking to surgery because they tend to be more virulent. You know, for me, I personally take, you know, I think the standard, like kind of immediate post-operative cataract ones are generally a little bit, you know, they're usually not as virulent. If it's bleb-associated post-traumatic, I'm certainly much more aggressive. But, you know, what I try to teach the fellows of the ones that I do bring to the OR is certainly less is more. Inevitably, almost most of these patients will have a thick pupillary membrane, which we're trying to pull out to help improve the view. And I've noticed, you know, the main idea is just to do a very limited vitrectomy, get the antibiotics in, and then get out. You know, I can't say I've ever repaired a primary retinal detachment at the time when I'm doing a primary vitrectomy for endophthalmitis, most of the time because the view isn't that great to start with, and maybe I won't even see if there is a retinal detachment. Of course, we do the B scan ahead of time, but generally for these cases, do a little bit of a core, inject the antibiotics, and get out of the eye.
Yeah, great point. And again, I think it's much more common to see it delayed and kind of monitoring after you do your surgery for a delayed detachment than seeing it during the primary surgery. Well, Nick and Dan, thank you so much for your time and taking the time to discuss these articles. I appreciate both of you, and I'm sure the listeners will appreciate your thoughts. Thank you again.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find all 260 episodes there, sorted by category. In addition, you can find links to subscribe and receive updates on the most recent episodes. We are also available on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can find us in your podcast app on your Apple or Android device. Thanks again to everyone who sends in episode ideas. We really appreciate it. The feedback helps us improve and get better. And thank you to anyone who leaves reviews in the Apple or Android store. Thank you to Drs. Daniel Chow and Nicholas Farber for joining me for this podcast. Thank you to Jennifer Ford and the team at PentaVision for allowing us to preview the articles in retinal position in advance. Thank you to Drs. Louis Kai and Angela Chang for editing and producing this episode, and for Dr. Michael Venicasa for the social media accompanying this episode. And thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patient care you deliver on a daily basis, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.